This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. Many of you already knew that. Joined as I am every week by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, the political director of CBS News, Steve Shigaris. Good afternoon and hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
The festive sounds you hear around us, Tortilla Coast, a brand new restaurant for the Takeout podcast. We're here for lunch, very near Capitol Hill, and geographically, for those of you who are not familiar with Washington, D.C., very close to the Republican National Committee headquarters and just a couple of blocks away from the Democratic National Committee headquarters. So the epicenter of politics in Washington, that's exactly where we are.
The shadow of the Capitol Dome.
Precisely.
Yes.
This show tries to accomplish a lot of things every week. One of the things it tries to accomplish is have a relentlessly fascinating conversation about politics and policy. One of the other things it tries to accomplish is take our listeners across the ideological spectrum. And if you look at last week's show and listen to it, we had Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossi, deeply associated with President Trump, his campaign, and aggressive advocates for that agenda. This week, let us just say something completely different. Our guest, very special guest, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Brand new to Congress, freshman year, represents the 7th Congressional District in the state of Washington, that's Seattle and surrounding King County, succeeding Jim McDermott, who held that seat for many, many terms in Congress, a progressive
years.
Democrat endorsed by Bernie Sanders when she was running for Congress, and Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader of the House Democrats, calls her a fierce voice on behalf of the resistance. So this is what you get on our show. One perspective last week, a completely different perspective this week, and we run the table with those perspectives for everyone in our audience. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. There's in your bio, it says you're the first woman born in India to be a member of Congress. That's historic in its own right. Tell us a little bit about your experience there and why you came to Congress and why you're in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I'm a proud immigrant, first Indian-American woman in the U.S. House of Representatives, born in India, raised there in Indonesia, and I came to the United States when I was 16 years old by myself. My parents had about $5,000 in their bank account, and they used all of it to send me here.
And you enrolled at Georgetown.
I enrolled at Georgetown.
At age 16.
I'm a proud Hoya. Yep, age 16. And, you know, I was supposed to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a business, or like an engineer, a business person. That was, if you take all your money and you send your kid across the ocean, that's what you're
Those
supposed
are the
to do.
Right.
Those are the choices. Politician was not part of it. Activist was not part of it. And I did. I actually worked on Wall Street for a couple of years after graduating from college to please my dad, really.
Then, you're not the first one to do that.
Not to
please
your
dad.
Current constituents, yeah. Though, I'm guessing.
No, right. No. But you know what? It taught me a lot. I feel like I got a lot of great experience out of that. I did get a master's in business. And then
I switched at
Northwestern University. And then I switched completely from the private sector. I actually sold defibrillators in eastern Indiana and western Ohio for a little bit.
I'll have to ask you what goes into that, but we'll ask you later.
I will tell you. I have a good story about that. And then I left and started working in global health and development for 10 years for a nonprofit organization that's sort of the operating arm of the Gates Foundation's mm-hmm. public health efforts around the world. So I ran a loan fund and I worked all over East Africa and or Africa in general, Asia, Latin America, working on reproductive rights, on family health care, maternal care, all of those things. Lived in villages for a couple of years on a fellowship and then came back to the United States. 9/11 happened. And I ended up starting what is now the largest immigrant advocacy organization in Washington State, one of the largest civil rights organizations there. We sued the Bush administration after 9/11 around the deportation of Somalis back to Somalia. We won. We stopped that deportation of 5,000 Muslim Americans across the country. Fought for comprehensive immigration reform, was a part of pushing for the DREAM Act, was a part of helping the Obama administration to get DACA implemented, was a part of the 2013 bill that passed the United States Congress for comprehensive immigration reform. Excuse me, the United States Senate.
Senate, right.
Not the Congress. I wish right. the Congress.
It
we
did
would
not.
Be in a very different place. And then decided to run for office because I was sort of tired of trying to get people to do the things that I thought we should do. And
just
I figured,
decided to run and see if you could do it yourself.
Not? Yeah. And, you know, also saw just way too few women, way too few people of color, way too few immigrants that represented, that were there. And so ran for the state senate in Washington State, became the first South Asian American ever elected to the Washington State Legislature, served there for 2 years, ran for Congress, and very proud to be here.
And became a citizen in 2000.
Became a citizen in 2000. It took me almost 18 years to get my citizenship. So for anybody out there who thinks that this is easy, that it's easy for people to get their citizenship, it's not. I went through a whole, you know, multitude of visas and alphabet
soup. And you entered the country as on a student visa, is that
correct? On a student visa. I've been on an H-1 visa, H-1B visa. I've been on a practical training visa. Then I was on a, you know, I had a green card, got married to a U.S. citizen, almost lost my green card when my son was born very unexpectedly at 26 and a half weeks in India, and I was due to come back to keep my status current. Actually lost my green card status, got it back. And then finally became a U.S. citizen in 2000. I tell you, I'm just so proud to be here. And it is, I think, what's so inspiring about America for so many places, for so many people around the world, that you can come here as a 16-year-old with nothing in your pocket and then become a United States member of Congress.
So when Nancy Pelosi talks about a voice of the resistance, what does she mean and what does resistance mean to you?
Resistance has come into effect since Trump got into office, I think, in terms of that term. And it's really, it means the pushing back on policies that undermine our democracy, that target certain people, that really strip away at the core of who America is. And it is started with the Women's March in January, the millions, tens of millions of people across this country and across the world who came out to say that this is unacceptable, continued with the Muslim ban and the protests against the Muslim ban, continued with health care and fighting back against Trump care and taking the stripping away of health care from tens of millions of Americans across the country. Seeing it now with the push for the Dream Act and the push for against this tax bill that is going to hurt millions of American families across the country.
You've been here 11 months. How do you think the resistance is going so far?
I think the resistance is very strong, and I think it's showing
but succeeding? How is it succeeding?
Well, I'll tell you, I think probably the biggest success was defeating Trump care. I think the victories in Virginia and Alabama are also part of this, because I think that they are in many ways a referendum on what this administration has been trying to move forward. The victories around the Muslim ban in the early days, I think, were big parts of this. And so I think success is a very difficult thing right now, because we're not in the majority. Democrats are not in the majority. We don't control the House, the Senate, or the presidency. Perhaps not for long. I hope not for long. But that is the case right now. And so we are an opposition party. I mean, the resistance is about being an opposition party. But I have said over and over again that we can't just be an opposition party. We also have to be a proposition party. And we have to put forward a vision of the America that we want to fight for and invite people into that.
So let me push back a little bit on that, because when I covered the Obama campaign, all of it, and the Obama administration early on, one of the most oft-repeated objections of the Obama administration early on is Republicans never gave us a chance. They were against everything we wanted to do right from the start. That was a grievance the Obama administration had. Is that not a fair grievance for the Trump administration to have? The Democrats never gave him a chance. We're resisting from the moment it started.
Well, under Obama, we had a very short period of time where all the chambers were controlled by Democrats, but it was not very long. And I think that the reality is that had Trump put forward an infrastructure package first, a credible one, a good one, it would have been, I think that would have been strategically smart for him, because I think there were Democrats who were ready to give him a chance at the very beginning. But the longer he went through his sort of litany of things that were firing up a very small portion of his base. And you look at his polling right now, and 32% or something, I can't remember what the latest number is, but a remarkably low number of people who actually think that what he's doing is good. And yet, he has, still has a lot of power because Republicans in the House and the Senate continue to give it to him.
That is the voice of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. She is our very special guest. You're listening to The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett with Steve Chigueras. Back in just a second.
You're listening to The Takeout.
And enjoying every moment of it, the festive sound you hear around us. Tortilla Coast is our restaurant. Ashley is our waitress. Hello, Ashley. It's great to see you.
How are you guys doing?
Congresswoman, what would you like for lunch?
How about like a cheese quesadilla or something like that?
That'd be great.
They have a cheese quesadilla at Tortilla Coast.
Figured.
I guarantee you. I'll have Arturo's special enchiladas, please, Ashley. Thank you.
Number one combo.
What's
with,
in there?
Beef taco. Please.
Okay.
Thank you.
And an enchilada, is that right?
And then around the horn.
Around the horn.
Yes.
So, Shaggy, take us away.
We talked
That's
about
Steve
resistance.
Shigueras, by the way, political director of CBS News.
We talked about resistance, impeachment, for or against on this president.
I was for having a debate on it. Look, I sit on
so
the
voted
Judiciary
for
Committee.
Congressman Green's.
I voted against the motion to table,
right,
which meant that it would come to the floor so
right,
we could actually discuss it. I have been incredibly frustrated about the fact that I sit on the Judiciary Committee. We are the only committee of record that refuses to have hearings on any of the issues that have been coming before us. Chairman Goodlatte has consistently said, oh, well, we need to wait for the Mueller investigation to be finished. Yesterday, we questioned Rod Rosenstein, and the only thing that Republicans had to say were around these text messages that were being, you know, being exchanged and the bias around.
And we'll get to that in a minute. A couple of names to get everyone back up. Bob Goodlatte, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Rod Rosenstein, deputy attorney general, the one who is empowered with overseeing the Robert Mueller special counsel investigation. Just like to keep everyone up because we drop
Thank
a lot
you.
Of names.
We drop a lot of names.
Yes.
You're absolutely
right. We have
right.
a lot of terminology. I always like to catch our audience up with that.
I want to pin you down on the impeachment question only because there are people in your party who are demanding members of Congress either they're demanding members of Congress say, yes, we want to impeach this president. So are
and
you
on what grounds?
Are you for that?
Well, what I mean, I just think what I have said before is there are many things he's done that I believe are impeachable offenses.
Already. Can you name one or two?
Yes. All of the contracts that he has around the Trump Hotel, on land that is actually congressional land, federal land,
that
is
being
leased to him. Mm-hmm. The number of places where there are significant conflicts of interest, not all of which we know because he hasn't released his tax returns. I believe that there are multiple places where he has already committed impeachable offenses. But impeachment, and this is important for listeners to know, I think, impeachment is really not a question of the law. It is a question of politics.
Absolutely.
You know, if impeachment is to go forward, the majority party has to vote for it because if you're in the minority, you don't have enough votes to move something forward. And so this has never been about has he committed the offenses that he, and you know, there have been presidents in the past who, and people in the past who have been impeached, and the standard is a very fluid
standard. It's a political
standard.
One. Yeah, right.
It is a political standard.
It was
of whether
political for
you
Andrew Johnson. It was legal and political with Richard Nixon. It
That's
was
right.
legal and political with Bill Clinton.
That's right.
And it was largely political with Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about Andrew Johnson and what he was impeached for, it was really for things he said,
right,
undermining his
right.
appointments he made. And so that standard is clearly addressed with this president. I think that he's in violation of the Emoluments Clause, very significant clause, again, for listeners who are out there. You know, a clause that basically says that you can't take gifts from foreign governments. And that is trying to prevent the influence of foreign governments. Look, there's a million places, and we've detailed it in the Judiciary Committee. But politically, we don't have the capital that it takes. Now, privately, I will tell you that there are many Republicans who believe that this president is ruining the Republican Party. They're not necessarily speaking out about it, but they are distraught about what they see happening.
Is it your belief, as leadership tamps down this impeachment talk now, that if the Democrats take over after the midterms, that there will be a movement to impeach this president?
I mean, let's see what happens, you know. But I think that it is, there is no question that we will at a minimum have hearings in our committees so that we can investigate this question and so that we can look at these constitutional violations that are happening. That's what we should be doing right now.
So to break it down a little bit, probably not the slogan for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee as it seeks a Democratic majority in 2018 will not be bring Democrats to power, we impeach the president, but you're not ruling it out. And under the heading of getting something done, that might be among the first priorities.
Well, what I'm saying is that we have a duty as Congress to oversee the actions of the president and this administration. And this administration is consistently violating not only long-held traditions and practices, things like releasing tax returns and creating a buffer between his assets and the work that he's doing as president, but also in terms of undermining, I mean, to come out and endorse a pedophile is something that even Republicans in Alabama couldn't take. And I think it is outrageous that there are many Republicans across this country who feel politically homeless because they don't feel like the Republican Party. Look, it used to be a party of fiscal conservatives. They're about to pass a tax bill that has a $1 trillion to a $1.5 trillion deficit that will create a deficit of $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion.
Just for clarity, Roy Moore, an accused abuser, not a convicted pedophile, just to clear that up.
Let me be clear that women in Alabama have put forward credible allegations that have been confirmed by people in a mall that you had to stay away from Roy Moore because he would prey on teenagers. And we have got to start standing up for the women across this country who, I'll tell you, every woman, Republican and Democrat, when I speak at press conferences, nods when I say we know exactly what is going on here. We have all been in these situations. It is time to stop that, and it is time to have the pendulum swing in the direction of justice for women across this country.
Where are you on investigations about the president on his sexual...
I've called for the president. I've called for investigation into the president. All Democratic women on the Judiciary Committee.
How does Congress do that?
Well, we suggested that the Judiciary Committee should have a hearing on this, and we should bring forward those women who have put forward these allegations, and we should have a real hearing on that.
And what do you say to supporters of the president who say this has already been litigated via election? People knew about it when he went to the polls last November, and they still voted for him.
I don't think that this is a standard that should be looked at in elections. I really don't. I think that these have to be investigated, and we have to stand up for something that has been swept under the rug for so long. I mean, the reason that this is roiling every industry, not just Congress, but, you know, the media, Hollywood, everywhere, business, is because I think women see what the president is doing, see what Republicans have allowed him to do, see what Democrats have allowed to have happen in the past. This is not a Republican-Democratic issue. And we found a lot of common cause with Republican women. I've been working very closely with Republican women who were just tired of it. You know, it is not acceptable. And we should not be, you know, sort of trying to parse this kind of groping is okay, but that kind of pedophilia is not. I mean, you know, it's just, it needs to stop. And we need a different standard.
Jurisdiction is an important question for Congress in all matters. What would be the jurisdictional territory on which the Judiciary Committee, if it were so inclined, were to have a hearing to investigate the president's conduct? The White House would say, and other Republican members of Congress said, happened before he was president. There's no jurisdiction there. Most of these would be violations of state laws, not federal laws, so there's no federal jurisdiction. What would be the jurisdictional validity of a Judiciary Committee investigation?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of things that don't have jurisdictional validity that we are hearing in the Judiciary Committee. But I think that it is that this is a man who is occupying the top office of the country. And some of these allegations are coming forward now as he is in office, even if they occurred before he came into office. And so I think that there's a there's a critical issue here around, you know, how we are going to stand up and listen to the women who really, I think, didn't get a hearing. And even Nikki Haley has said, I thought that was very interesting to watch.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
Appointed by Trump, you know, a strong Republican, former governor
In South Carolina.
And even she, I thought,
said
was,
they deserve to be heard.
They deserve to be heard.
More on this topic, all under the heading of Me Too, when you come back to The Takeout, which I know you will. I'm Major Garrett.
How do you think people should assess the accusers of the president?
Well, I mean, the same thing is women who accuse anyone should be heard. They should be heard and they should be dealt with. And I think we heard from them prior to the election. And I think any woman who has felt violated or felt mistreated in any way, they have every right to speak up.
And does the election mean that's a settled issue?
That's for the people to decide. I know that he was elected, but, you know, women should always feel comfortable coming forward, and we should all be willing to listen to them.
That was the voice of Nikki Haley, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. Our very special guest, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, referred to Nikki Haley as we came very close to the end of our second segment. We're going to pick up on that now. What do you think is the potential legal, but certainly political impact of Nikki Haley, someone appointed by the president, as you mentioned, definitely a part of the president's team, saying, even after the election, to quote her directly, we should all be willing to listen to them, and they should feel comfortable coming forward?
I think it's very important. She's an important voice in the president's cabinet. And so I think
the first of those to say this.
And the first of those to say this. I thought it was very courageous of her. And I do think that we are having these conversations in the corridors, Republican and Democratic women, as I mentioned. And I think that people understand that obviously we're going to have to take the lead on this conversation. We're not the only ones. We hope our male colleagues will stand up and speak out on these issues. But I think it's significant for Nikki Haley to say what she did, and I'm grateful to her.
Speaking of members of Congress, you had an episode that I want to play a clip from, if we can. Tatiana, can we play that clip as you're adjusting our time clock here on CBS? This is CBSN. It's all real time. This would be clip number one, Tatiana, if you please.
You know, I rarely do this, but I'm deeply disappointed in my good lady from Washington. Doesn't know damn thing what she's talking about. Alaskans, the first Americans, support this amendment. And I really am disturbed. You may not know me, young lady, but I'm deeply disturbed. I am still talking.
Tatiana's words. The gentleman has already impugned my motives by saying that I don't know a damn thing about what I'm talking about.
I didn't say damn. You said it.
He's now called me young lady. And, Mr. Chairman, I ask that he take down his words.
Gentlemen will suspend.
Well, that was an encounter in Congress during a hearing, a markup, I believe. The male voice you heard was Representative Don Young, Republican from Alaska. The other voice you heard, our special guest, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Tell us what that was about and what the underlying issue was. And I assume you knew what you were talking about. Let's just say that up front.
It was actually on the floor.
Oh, the floor. Okay.
Yeah, it was actually on the floor of the House. And Don Young had proposed an amendment to a bill that allowed for predatory hunting on federal lands.
What does that mean?
It basically means that if you were hunting bear, first of all, that you'd be allowed to hunt bear and that you would be able to use techniques like, for example, using glazed donuts to lure the bear within 2 or 3 feet and then shoot the bear right in the head. Or shoot cubs from helicopters above. And so, really, multiple issues around federal lands, around hunting practices.
And glazed donuts.
And glazed donuts. It's amazing how popular those
donuts.
Are. And so he had proposed this amendment. I claimed time in opposition. It was late at night. It was around 9 or 9:30, I think. And I spoke about why I thought this was not appropriate, that it's federal lands and that we have people from all over the country. I had a whole set of arguments. And then he did this. And I have to say, I was just sort of a little stunned, first of all. You know, when I was in the state Senate, the Senate president will gavel down somebody for inappropriate remarks. So it took me 30 seconds or so when he told me I didn't know a damn thing about what I was talking about, clearly against House rules. And then when he went on to, you know, just be so condescending and dismissive and calling me young lady, and I had just had enough, so I asked him to take down his words, which, for people who are listening out there, that is essentially the way that you take on a personal insult that has been made against you on the floor.
And procedurally, it's a point of personal privilege, and the parliamentarian has to rule, and the chair has to recognize it.
Correct. And the parliamentarian, everything shuts down. So there were all kinds of, it was silent in the chamber. The parliamentarian came out. Paul Ryan's floor leader came out to talk to me. Said, will you accept a motion to strike his words from the record? And I said, not without a public apology. I do not believe that it's appropriate for somebody to do that. I was elected by 750,000 people, just like he was. Actually, later I found out that he was elected by fewer people than that.
But, it is Alaska.
But I believe it's ridiculous, and I don't think we should have to stand up for it.
So you guys are best friends now.
Well, he did apologize, mm-hmm. and I accepted his apology, and I said, look, we should get to know each other, and we should work together on things. I've been in this situation before. I've been in it in committee as well. Daryl Issa did the same thing to me, and I thanked him on Twitter for mansplaining naivete to me, and that went all over the place as well. And I just think that, look, this is one of the last bastions of places that looks the way it does. And I'm married to a wonderful white man, so no offense here, but, we need some representation from the people across the country.
Too many of us, bro.
Too many of us, bro.
And we need to fight back and say, listen, if you're a woman of color, you don't have to deal with this. You do not have to accept this. You can stand up and take the high road. Do it appropriately. But I'm not going to stand back as people dismiss me for being
Steve,
a woman.
Steve, another aspect of this debate.
Right. So I want to add, this was a quote that was reported in Politico this week. A colleague of yours, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, Democrat of Ohio, reportedly said in a closed Democratic caucus meeting, I saw a member yesterday with her cleavage so deep it was down to the floor, and what I've seen, it's really an invitation. And then she followed up with a statement saying it's not what she really meant. But is there a generational situation here, at least among women, when it comes to dealing with these kinds of Me Too?
I think there
is. And what's appropriate and what signals is there a signal?
I do want to point out Marcy Kaptur 71.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do think that there is to some extent. And, many of us were shaking our heads at that statement.
Did you hear that from her?
I was not there. Okay. I missed it. I was not there that day.
But it became a topic of conversation.
I saw it, and it became a topic of conversation. And I even had, after the Don Young thing happened, I even had some older women come up to me on both sides and say, many who just thanked me for taking him on, but a few that said, oh, I'd love to be called a young woman. And my response was, and I think I said this in an interview, there are many ways to compliment the intelligence of a woman, and calling her young lady is not one of them. In my mind,
especially when preceded by you don't know a damn thing that you're talking about.
Right, that doesn't
that
help.
Really compromises that whole compliment scenario.
Yes, and I think that there's some part of culture that's baked into us, even if we're younger, older, whatever. But our generations, the younger generations, do have, I think, a much more honed attention to racism, sexism, all of these things.
And so do you feel that you have to teach older generations that things have changed? Or, there was a definite outcry for what she said. So I guess the reaction to it, do you think that was justified?
Yeah, I do. I think that, I believe we have to take on our own lovingly. I don't think we should just support everything just because we're all Democrats. But I do think we should be loving about it, and I think we should recognize on both sides.
That it may come from not malice, but misunderstanding.
Yeah, and I think she did follow up with a statement that kind of clarified. But, look, we may agree that there should be some sort of a dress code. I would never say, and most of us would never say, that women somehow are asking for it. That's what it made it
right,
sound like.
Inviting this kind of behavior.
I mean, it's just it's just outrageous. And I hope and believe that she didn't mean it, and that it just kind of came out the wrong way. And, you know, I think that's sometimes you learn the hard way, too, that that's something you're not going to say. I mean, Daryl Issa actually came up and apologized to me recently for what he said on committee. And he said, you know, sometimes you just learn from the throwaway statements.
More than the prepared statements. Because the throwaway statements sometimes are more reflective of the gut instincts and your baseline thought process.
Correct.
And it's that baseline process and set of assumptions behind it that this is really about addressing.
But I also believe we have to move past some of these things. You know, somebody, a Democratic colleague, came up to me today and asked me, you know, he said, I want to know about this Don Young thing because I wanted to work with him and people were telling me not to because of how he treated you. And I said, no, you should work with him. You know, hold him accountable, but work with him.
That's the voice of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, our very special guest you are listening to and most thoroughly enjoying The Takeout.
You're listening to The Takeout.
And thoroughly enjoying it in podcast land on CBSN. Hello, CBSN. And on great radio stations across America. Thank you for taking in this show in whatever way you take it in. And riding along with us as we take you from one end of the ideological spectrum in American politics to another. You know, we don't have much of a merchandise mart at the Takeout Podcast.
We're working on it.
It's got one shelf and only one product, the Takeout Podcast stickers, which CBSN audience you see right here, signed by me. That's it. We're going to beef up the merchandise.
The value of these things
in 2018.
We don't want to undervalue.
Exactly.
They're
very valuable on eBay.
Highly sought after.
Yes, exactly. And there's only one way you can obtain this much coveted Takeout Podcast sticker. Only one way.
By the way, we've had 390 people from around the world,
this way,
including one person from Indonesia.
Wow.
You said you spent time in Indonesia.
I did. I spent 10 years there.
So how do they do it, Steve?
There's only one way to do it.
Only one way.
If you'd like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News, at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
Every single state has had someone who has sent in a self-addressed stamped envelope, also from the District of Columbia, and 10 countries
11.
Not named
11.
Not named the United States of America.
Wow.
We
That's
don't
impressive.
Call them foreign countries.
That is impressive.
We call them countries not named the United States of America.
Very progressive of you.
Well, you know, it's just respectful. We're about respect here. We're about respect. When we talk about policies here in Washington, you have a history involved and linked to immigration. You mentioned your long legal journey to obtain citizenship. There are many who support President Trump who say you did it the right way, and you should be offended at people who do it the wrong way, who come into this country illegally or overstay their visas or somehow break the compact that they established when they entered the country legally. And they should be deported because they've, in their first orientation toward America, violated a federal law. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that the majority of Americans actually believe that immigrants are good for the country and that we should have a functioning immigration system that allows people to come in legally. The majority of Americans actually do not support deporting everybody across the country. That's about 30%, depending on which polls you look at. Most people don't understand that the immigration system has not been updated for decades, since the late 60s. I mean, there have been a few things that have been done, amnesty that was passed by President Bush, but really, overall, the system has never been updated to accommodate the economy and the families that we have in the United States. And so I often say to people, did you know, for example, that a certain agricultural visa in this country only has 4,500 people that can apply for that visa? Did you know that if you are a Filipino and you want to bring your child into the country, and you're here legally, that it takes 22 years to actually bring your adult child into the country? these are things that most Americans don't know. And so once you explain it to people that the system just hasn't been updated because it's been used as a political football, most people are in favor of a comprehensive reform of the system that allows for people to come in legally, that allows for us to know who is here, and that is humane. And so that's, you know, I think President Trump and some Republicans, Steve King on the Judiciary Committee, a few others, really use this as a wedge issue because it's an easy
wedge
issue.
But you've heard the slogan, what part of illegal don't you understand? You've heard that slogan. Like, it's an affront to American law if you enter the country illegally. Is there a response you have for that simple question?
Yeah, the response is that we need to update the system because you can't have it both ways. You know, you can't have the reality is if you deported 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, you wouldn't, no industry, Tortilla Coast, say goodbye. Hotels, say goodbye. Fruit, cherry, apples, crawfish in Louisiana. I mean, these industries would collapse. Dairy would collapse.
So apples in Washington.
Apples in Washington. We have been using the labor of immigrants and very, you know, sort of hypocritically, I would say, then trying to blame them for not coming in when we haven't actually given the law any kinds of changes to allow for them to be here legally. And most people who say, what part of illegal don't you understand, they actually don't know that there isn't a line you can get into. They don't know that. And so when we explain that, we find a lot of people, and I'll tell you, I had a teletown hall a couple months ago, and I have people in my district who, believe it or not, voted for Trump, voted for me, and are for the DREAM Act. I think good Americans.
We need to get them on the show.
Right. Good Americans across this country.
That's an interesting guess right there.
And Democrats understand that immigrants have been good for this country, that most of us are very, you know, not many generations removed mm-hmm. from immigrants, unless you're Native American. Could have come over on a slave ship, or you could have come over to escape persecution, but every one of us has a tie to an immigrant story.
Can I ask you a question about a specific case which the president has used was in the news recently, the alleged murder of Kate Steinle, and them using that as an example of what is broken about the immigration system. The man who was accused of this had been deported and come back multiple times in the country and was accused of killing this woman randomly in California.
And then acquitted.
And then acquitted.
Acquitted. Right?
Acquitted. He was found not guilty
right.
by the jury.
So, your take, first of all, on that, the tie of that story to the immigration system and the fact that Republicans are using this as an example of what's broken about the immigration
yeah.
system.
I find it deplorable. I find it deplorable that you would take a very tiny percentage. We can find U.S. citizens who have murdered people. And we don't say
repeat offenders.
And we don't say that all U.S. citizens are therefore horrible and problems to our country. This is a tiny portion of the people, and all of us believe that people who do bad things should face consequences. And, you know, and so, and this guy was acquitted. So, I mean, that's a whole other story. But, you know, this is a case that Trump put forward as what is wrong with the system. He went through the justice system. A jury acquitted him of this. So we have lost due process in the immigration system. The Trump administration has ramped up deportation, but I will tell you that the Obama administration did too. This is not just a Republican thing that's happened, you know, kind
a
of
very
bowing.
Prominent immigrant advocate in Washington at one time called President Obama deporter in chief.
Yes, yes, I think I remember that very clearly. As a matter of fact, I believe it's got, you know, quite a few YouTube videos
so you
if you
it.
Search for my
very
name.
Quickly, we've got 45 seconds left. On the question of sanctuary cities, Seattle is one. San Francisco was one. The Justice Department, through President Trump, says that's a bad thing. Violation of federal law, not collaborating with the federal law, and adhering to federal existing statute. Your response?
They're going to be taken to court if they try to cut off funding, because in Seattle, we crafted our policy very clearly to say that we are not withholding information from the feds, but we are not asking about immigration status. Totally different things. And we just, our attorney general and our mayor just submitted a letter around a threat to take away our JAG funding, our criminal justice funding
from the Justice Department.
From the Justice Department. The courts have clearly said you can't connect unconnected things, and that's what the Justice Department is trying to do.
That is the voice of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, our very special guest on The Takeout. Thank you so much for joining us. We thank the Tortilla Coast Restaurant and Ashley, our fantastic waitress, for providing a great lunch. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
For more from this week's conversation, download the Takeout Outtake Especial Tuesday morning, wherever you listen to your podcasts. The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari and Katiana Krachenko. CBSN production by Alex Zuckerman and Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, visit takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News Radio.